This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. If you've heard the sounds of the Southeast on the weekends here on WUTC, you've heard Amy Campbell. She is the host and producer of the Tennessee Farm Table and Sweetgrass, Saturdays from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. on this station, originating from East Tennessee's own WDVX in Knoxville. Farm Table shares the stories of the people who produce, preserve, and present the food of this region, while Sweetgrass offers what it calls a softer side of bluegrass with a peppering of classic country. Amy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Ray. I love being able to share all the stories from Tennessee Farm Table with a bunch of new ears and listeners and everybody down there in Chattanooga. And then Sweetgrass, I hope everybody's liking it. You're going to hear Dolly Parton on there because it's my way of thinking that we love Dolly, but do you really ever hear her on the radio? Not a lot. So you're going to hear her on Sweetgrass.
And you do, and I have. And it's not just the Dolly Parton tunes that most people know. That's what really grabs me by the ears.
Good. I try to seek those out and more acoustically. I try not to have the music that I pick out for that show to be grating on the nerves, thus Sweetgrass. It's pretty much vintage music. Most of it's vintage, a little bit of classic country or vintage bluegrass. I say vintage, which is really an incorrect term. It's more stuff from the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, probably the third generation of bluegrass.
And it rounds out this hour that begins with Tennessee Farm Table. Tell us more about Farm Table and how your interests coalesced into this program.
I have a long history of promoting local foods and the love of farming and trying to promote our regional farmers from former jobs with the city of Knoxville and PR, running events and things like that to attract more visitors to farmers markets. And a group of us started a farmers market here in our little town of Maryville because I just think it's really important and always have thought it was important to promote regional food. And I just love people's stories. And I'm guilty of talking too much. And I love to hear people tell their stories. Just after about 25 years of local food advocacy, I came to the people who are in charge of programming for WDVX, and I said, you know, I don't know why there is not a food show, one of the biggest parts of our culture. I said, I'd love to do a food show, but I'd like to have ownership of it so I could also have be a podcast and go to different markets and things like that. And they said, absolutely, we'd love to have it. So that's how it started. I just wanted to share stories of people that are creating our foods, be it farmers or chefs or food writers or musicians, people that kind of keep these old stories alive. And then also people that have moved to this area and how they take these ingredients that are typically seen as Appalachian or Southern foods and come up with brand new ways of cooking. I just think that it's important to keep these stories on the air. And ultimately, I want more people to buy local food and to come together through our differences over breaking a big pan of cornbread together.
Indeed.
Yeah, I do think that food and music really help us to find our commonalities.
And in finding those stories, you go out to these places. We hear you go out to these places. We hear you out at the farmers markets. We hear you out at the parks, talking to these people, asking them to tell their stories.
That's right. I think it's important to see the farm, see how it's raised. I like to really know before I put something on the air, how the food is raised, the quality of the person, and their intent that goes into it. I just think that that's really important. I try to really get a broad spectrum of people. I might have one day Ronnie Lundy, that famous food writer, James Beard Award-winning chefs, or Ronnie's won a couple James Beard Awards. And then the next day, I might have a mamaw that has lived her life near Cades Cove. I like to keep a variety of guests and try to go to where they are. So I get sound effects and look at their home, and they pull out recipe books. And you just can't get that if somebody comes to a generic little studio.
It's about being as discerning in the stories as you're shopping for the food yourself.
That's a good point. It really is. And I want to help people find really, truly wholesome food and help support the farmers, and also where to find seed and how we can keep our genetic diversity in the food that we grow in our gardens by knowing more about heirloom seed and people who save seed and all that. I try to just promote old ways that are new again.
And how would you describe what's unique about those old ways in this part of Appalachia, in East Tennessee?
A lot of us, including myself, just have gone to the store for everything. And we, after mechanized farming and food production started way back in the late 40s, we've just grown up just assuming everything. This is really a broad brush I'm painting here, but we've grown up buying everything from the store. I just think it's important for us to all have more of a sense of self-reliance and to educate ourselves of how our food is made. And then that leads into wanting to eat foods that are less filled with fillers and preservatives. And I just think we generally eat healthier if we eat the foods that we can grow ourselves, or just a little bit of food. If we just grow maybe some spinach or a tomato plant, it just feels like you've really done something. And it's a real different feeling than going and throwing that thing on the little U scanner at the big box store. Sure feels good to grow your own tomato and eat that tomato sandwich in the middle of the summer.
Favorite things that you have grown right here in East Tennessee?
Okay, I'd have to say this past year, I've grew some beautiful green beans. And I always heard people loving green beans. And you open a can of green beans and they just taste so blah. But I got seed from a family that used to live in Cades Cove before the Great Smoky Mountains National Park took over that area and they moved out of the cove. And there was a fella named Kermit Corrin who saved a seed called Kermit's Striped Stick Bean. And I got some of those seed from his great-grandson and I planted those and we picked those beans and just barely steamed them a little bit in the microwave with a little butter. And they were the best green beans. It tasted nothing like a can of green beans. And I saved some seed if anybody would like for me to share some seed with them. It's really worth planting it. It's just an amazingly delicious bean.
How about favorite recipes from here in East Tennessee?
There are several of them. I think one of the easiest and most delicious things that we rely upon is a kilt salad. My grandmother from Mississippi taught me how to do it. You can use any kind of lettuce or kind of stout green, like a mustard green. And basically, it's what you eat when you have no money and you want something green and filling. And it's delicious. How I do it is I get my cast iron skillet out and I put a little dollop of Benton's bacon grease. Well, I'm not giving an advertisement, but Benton's bacon out of Madisonville is a great bacon. And so I save a little bit of the grease and get it piping hot. And I've washed my mustard greens and I've chopped them real rough. And I just toss coat those really quickly and cook them maybe 2 minutes. You put it on a platter and then you can put a little balsamic vinegar on that if you want to, and crumbled bacon and a boiled egg. You've got a good little old-fashioned Appalachian meal that will stick with you.
How do you keep surprising yourself when it comes to the outdoors, when it comes to ingredients, when it comes to recipes, when it comes to music? Because you've covered so much of the same ground from so many different angles for so many years doing this.
People have asked me that, but I feel like I have just scratched the surface with people I've been able to reach out to and be able to talk with. There's so many people I'm just itching to get to. It's funny, when I first got into this, I thought, okay, I've interviewed that person and now that is covered. But then people keep evolving and people keep doing different things. So this young man I've seen, for instance, there's this young man named Stan Sharp, and I knew him when he was kind of a teenager, and now he's a bluegrass caller, and now he's married and grows all kinds of great food. So that's going to be an interesting show. You know, 10 years ago, he was still just a kid with no particular urge to be a bluegrass caller, but he calls square dances now and goes all over the place. That's a for instance. And I just think that as people grow up and their children grow up and they get into this food business, restaurants open and close, that there's an ever evolving sort of list of recipes to kind of pull out of people.
How have you adjusted hosting and producing the show this past year because of the pandemic?
It's really been hard. I have had a lot of the shows pre-recorded and put away in what I call my pantry. I have pulled some out and updated them and replayed some several shows that are just really good shows. But it's been difficult. For instance, I have a fella coming over for an interview to our home, and we have a barn, and I'm calling it a barn cast. We can sit six. I know. Got a tripod with my little recorder on it, and my earphones, a 6-foot cord to the recorder, and 2 chairs 6 feet away. I'll wear a mask, and it's ventilated, a big barn. I've just had to go to people's homes, and we've had to record outside. I take it real seriously, and I don't want to be presumptive and show up at somebody's house and not follow safe practices. I'm really concerned. I have elderly family. I want to stay safe for them. I don't want them to be sick. So I've just had to get scrappy and record in the barn or outside, or as soon as I pull up somewhere and have it all planned out, somebody's going to start up some power washer or something like that. It is something else.
You mentioned before we started our conversation that you have a few donkeys there. Does the recording in the barn, shall we say, aggravate them, or do they just not notice?
Well, it would kind of add a little bit of flavor if they would start their big, long bellows during recording. But they just might. They're something else. They're curious animals. They just stand out in the rain when it's pouring rain, and they will just start hollering when there's really nothing much going on. They're something else. They might add to a recording.
Sound engineers. What else do you have there in the barn on the property besides the two donkeys?
Well, we have an old orange cat named Hobbs, and he's mommy's baby. He follows us everywhere. And then I've got a good-sized garden. It's just a hobby garden. We have about 5 acres, and we essentially mow a bunch of grass every week when the weather's really warm. But I enjoy growing food and sharing it with neighbors and such.
Beyond listening to Tennessee Farm Table and Sweetgrass here on WUTC, Saturday afternoons between 2 and 3, where can people go online to follow all that you do?
Basically, everything's at TennesseeFarmTable.com. And that's where I love the podcast notes and pictures of my guests, and then links to them or places where they might be involved. And that's pretty much where I try to steer people to that as a hub. And also the podcast is on Apple Podcasts and generally all those podcast platforms.
And if people heard you talking about seeds earlier and they want to reach out to you directly, how can you do that?
Absolutely. If they go to my website, I've got a little form. If they want to email me through that, I'd love to hear from them. And as long as it doesn't get out of hand, I'm happy to mail them to them. And I'd love for them to know the story behind the seed. Almost as important as the food itself are the stories behind it.
You can't have the food without the stories, or the stories without the food.
It's so true.
Amy Campbell, thanks so much for Tennessee Farm Table and Sweetgrass here on WUTC.
Thank you so much, Ray. It's an honor.
Here in Chattanooga, the performers of the Pop-Up Project are known for their immersive events and site-specific films that tell the stories of our community. While they have had to adjust during this pandemic, their art moves forward. Maddie Waters Cofield and Jules Downham are the co-founders and co-directors of the Pop-Up Project and the co-directors of the upcoming film, The Light We Share.
Maddie, Jules, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Tell us more about the Pop-Up Project.
The Pop-Up Project is a nonprofit production and dance company based in Chattanooga. And we founded this organization in 2016. We had both just come back from opposite coasts. I lived in California and Maddie in New York. And we came back to Chattanooga and we're looking for dance opportunities in town.
To kind of start to create opportunities for ourselves and our area's artists, we decided to start popping up around town and create site-specific dance pieces in collaboration with local musicians and a local cinematographer, Tim Cofield, and post the material for free online to start building an audience and to show our community what professional dancers that live here and start to say, hey, we're here. Check out our work.
And it's not only about building an audience, it's about building community.
Our organization is based on collaboration. We have collaborated with over 100 plus artists, probably close to 200 in the last 3 years. We realize that we are not the experts at everything. We want to bring the experts to the table and create something that's unique and specific to our area sometimes, or specific to a certain story of someone in our area. And we collaborate with visual artists, spoken word artists, musicians, makeup and hair, wardrobe, dancers, actors, musicians, to create a unique art piece.
What are some of the performances that have really stood out in the past few years?
Like Maddie mentioned, a lot of what we do has started with film, and that is because when we wanted to build an audience, we realized that we needed to meet people where they were, which was on their computers, on their phones, with their bathrobes on, drinking their coffee on a Sunday morning. We wanted to start there. And so we started with film, and some of our most memorable early films. One we did in an abandoned warehouse where we brought actually dancers in from all over the country, and they came to Chattanooga and we put on a show and a party that was filmed in 2019. Our two dance films that we've done with Ballet Tennessee and their Dance Alive program, which included 70 children, those have been very memorable. Those are all films, all the things that I mentioned. Our live shows, we want to include artist collaborators, but we also want to include the audience. And so we try to do everything immersive and we want them to participate. Two things come to mind for me. And one was an early show we did at the Hunter Museum, where that was a comedy show. It was inspired by Wayne White when his exhibit was in town, and we were bearded ladies and we had the judges going through the audience, and the audience members ended up grabbing prop sets and dancing with them. We always want to make everybody part of the process. And then the other is a show we put on at the Alstom facility in collaboration with SoundCore in 2019, and Urban Story Ventures let us take over their huge warehouse, Big Blue Bays at Alstom, and we had an immersive art event with about 40 artists participating.
That event in particular sold out within the first week or two. We had nearly 1,000 audience members, and it was a one-time only event.
And all of this, of course, took place before the pandemic. How did the Pop-Up Project adjust throughout 2020?
Just to give you a little bit of context, we had been raising funds to have a 7-week immersive art event that included around 50 artists, where the audience would walk through installations and see live performances, interact with those installations, have music, have a party afterwards. We were just so close, just a day before signing that lease. And then the global pandemic was announced and we went in lockdown. After many sleepless nights and about a month or two of just sitting with it and trying to figure out how to move forward, we realized that this was not going to be over anytime soon. So we said, what do we have? We have some funds that we've raised. We have the artists that we can work with, and we can do this in a controlled environment if it's film. We can still create. We can work with installation artists, spoken word, and dancers. And we actually had a dancer approach us and said, I have a story. I want to tell a story. Will you help me? And that just kind of snowballed into what is now called The Light We Share, which is a full-length dance film. We started filming in about September of 2020.
One of the reasons we chose to move forward, because when we were trying to decide what to do, it was like, do we wait? Do we just hold this money? You know, as an arts organization, you get that big gift to you to make your dream come true. It's like, should you hold it and wait until this passes and then fulfill your dream? But our mission is to create fair wage opportunities for artists. And we do it around these large scale events that bring artists together and large scale productions to work on things together. But we also want to pay them fair and one day living wages. And we realized that the arts sector is one of the hardest hit economically from the pandemic. It's just been devastating to professional artists throughout the country. And so we knew we had to use those resources and we needed to do it in the way we do, collaboratively and putting something really big and beautiful together. That was all part of the decision-making into moving forward with film.
There's an emphasis with this film, but also with the mission of the pop-up project as a whole on diversity, on social justice.
Yeah. So after one of our artists approached us, he said, I want to tell my story of what it's like to be a big Black man living in our town. And we opened it up to our core team and said, does anybody else have a story they want to tell? And one of them is about reconciliation with his father. One is about her and her very kind of new partner dealing with this pandemic. One is about a sister who is dealing with a brother with a lot of mental health issues. Another one is about immigration and being separated from his mother for 7 years. These are all very personal stories that have happened to these dancers. And we worked with them each individually on how can we tell this story through dance and through music and through film. That's how the process began.
You're absolutely correct to say that there is something about this film and our past films and our organization in general that has a social justice lens. And I think we don't necessarily go out and seek social justice stories, but we go out to seek stories in our dance community, in our community in general. And we try to tell that story as authentically as possible from the viewpoint of the person we're hearing this story from. And if you're telling stories from humans and communities that are diverse, you're automatically going to get a social justice lens if you tell it authentically.
And then what challenges have you had in making this film during this pandemic?
We've, you know, had to cancel when numbers have spiked. We've lost, you know, some of the locations that we were going to film at. We worked with Ricardo over at Howard High School, but they had to shut their doors. We were shooting in their auditorium. So maneuvering around that and making sure that our artists are safe, that we're remembering to get rapid tested, to wear our mask, to socially distance, and then also just having to reschedule, that's been pretty difficult to work around, but we've managed.
Yeah, I think space access has been huge. We lost our rehearsal space early because we were working with a theater center and they needed to get stricter on their numbers through the door right at the time we were having more dancers come in. A lot of stuff shifted to outdoors. We shot a lot of things outdoors. We rehearsed outdoors. We started rehearsing in July. It was 95 degrees wearing masks. We've shot in the rain. Rapid tests. So our dancers have just been like getting swabs up their noses this whole time and waiting in long lines, hours and hours to get this every single time we shoot. So it's been quite a feat in like perseverance and dedication from everybody involved. We have 54 artists involved this year.
What's the timeline at this point for releasing the film?
Our plan right now is to release early summer in different private screenings. So if we need to have a drive-in movie, we'll have a drive-in movie, maybe do it at Miller Park. We want our community to see it first. We're not going to release it online immediately. It will go through first screenings within our community. We want to offer it to our audience, also to our funders, and of course the artists and their families. A lot of their families are in the film or involved in the film in some way. So we want them to see it in person, and we want to do that safely, and we want to do that first. It will be released within our community. That we'll have events around that if it's safe to do so. And then if not, we'll adjust. Maybe we'll do watch parties on Zoom. You know, we kind of have just to stay flexible and see what happens. But we feel pretty good that it will be ready to be viewed by the early summer within our community. And then it will go through the film festival circuit.
And where can people go online to keep up on the film and everything at the Pop-Up Project?
They can follow us on Instagram. We are the Pop-Up Project, or Facebook, again, the Pop-Up Project, or our website is thepopupproject.org. We will be announcing there as well.
All right. Maddie, Jules, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots. This afternoon we have a treat for you. This is the first half of a show from the Isis Theatre in Asheville, featuring Samson and Delilah. Samson is Franklin Keel. He is also the associate principal cellist in the Asheville Symphony Orchestra. Delilah is singer and guitarist Rebecca O'Quinn. Rebecca is also the lead singer and guitarist for Rebecca and the Reckoning, as well as a dancer and choreographer with the Asheville Ballet. Recorded on Valentine's Day, their set with pianist Brad Kurtioff and drummer David Cohen is mostly love songs, but from a wide range of writers.
But it's all right, 'cause it's midnight tonight. What can I do? I'm falling in love. I'm just a no-hand dog roaming around, oh Lord. I got all this and heaven above. Oh,
take it back a couple tunes here to some old time country. Any old time country fans up in this room? Up here, yeah. All right. Patsy Cline's one of my favorite ones to do.
She came along.
thoughts can bring on. I still care for you. How strange, how strange, how strange, how strange. If you got leaving on your mind, tell me now, get it over. Hurt me now, get it over. If you've got leaving on your mind, if there's a new love in your heart, hurt me now, get it over. Tell me now, get it over. If there's a new love in your heart, if there's a new love in your heart. Well, thank y'all very much. Thank you. I appreciate that. This is the part of the show where I'll let you know that we're going to sing some sad songs about love. But I want to reassure you before you start running for the hills that we will sing some happy songs about love. We'll sing some sad songs. We'll sing some bittersweet songs. And we'll sing some funny songs about love. We're going to do one more silly country tune. But first, I want to introduce these guys behind me and to my right and to my left. This is Franklin Keel over here on the cello thingy. That is a cello, by the way, in case anyone was wondering. That was there during the assemblage of that contraption. It was quite intelligent. That was very nice. This is also Brad Kurtioff on the keys over here. Yep. Laying down some keys. We also have David Cohen back here on the drums. Yeah, thank you. We're going to play one more tune for you, and then we're going to let these guys go and then switch up the feel a little bit. This is a Ernest Tubb and Loretta Lynn tune.
Well, I slipped out of the house about sundown while Mama was washing her hair. And you can bet your bottom dollar she'll come looking for me when she finds out I'm not there. And if she catches her sweet thing running around, I know there'll be the devil to pay. She'll come blowing like a cyclone right through the door and hear exactly what she'll say. baby all my money on payday. Except a little she don't know that I got. Cause this cute little waitress at the corner cafe, and she seems to like me quite a lot. And we were sitting in the back booth having a talk. She believed in every word that I said. And when the door flew open, Loretta walked in, and I ain't loud enough to wake the dead.
Well, has anybody here seen Sweet Thing? I got a notion he'll be headed this way. Cause when my Sweet Thing is out, I'm catting around and find a sandbox like this to play. I wanna tell all you barroom roses, if my Sweet Thing does have a mind, you better take my advice. And if you blink more than twice, you better have something in your eyes.
She ain't kidding either.
Thank you very much. That's a silly one. Ernest Tubb and Loretta Lynn. Any fans of Loretta Lynn in here? Yeah, I like to do a lot of Loretta Lynn. We're going to let these two have a little breaksies. Every once in a while, Franklin Keel gives me the opportunity to play some classical music with him, which is quite an honor. So we're going to let him set up there, and I'm going to put my music over there, and we're going to do one by Bach called The Well-Tempered Clavier. Is that right? Thank you very much, everyone. That was a real treat to be able to perform that for you. Thank you. Y'all, welcome back on the stage, Mr. Brad Kurtioff and David Cohen.
That will run down over me. Oh, won't see your smiling face, I will pray,
pray, pray
to the one I love.
Yeah, hey, that's a good one. Yeah. All right, ready? All right, we're going to funk it up a little bit. It's a Wood Brothers tune.
If you get to worry, what you ought to do is sing. If you get worried, what you ought to do is sing. If you get worried, what you ought to do is sing. Sing about your trouble and it just might pass. And if you get lost, what you ought to do is sing. If you get lost, what you ought to do is sing. If you get lost, what you ought to do is sing. Sing about your trouble, and it just might pass.
Sing about your trouble,
and it just might pass. Sing about your get lost, what you ought to do is sing. If you get broken, what you ought to do is sing. If you get broken, what you ought to do is sing. Sing about your trouble and it just might pass. Sing about your trouble and it just might pass. Sing about.
Thank you very much.
Samson and Delilah, Rebecca O'Quinn and Franklin Keel, along with pianist Brad Kurtioff and drummer David Cohen in the Isis Theatre in Asheville this past Valentine's Day. We will have the second half of this show tomorrow here on Scenic Roots.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at wutc.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.